naval ship named after him, the USS John Lewis,
is
the first of a support ship that is going to be a part of a fleet of other ships that are named after civil rights leaders. We've come a long way.
Cultural appropriation or finally honoring more of our civil rights history.
I had the privilege of taking him to the airport once.
Nice. You've been listening to News with My Dad here on X-Ray. Stay tuned for Thank You Democracy. We got guest host Stacey Hall. My name's Jeff. Radio's yours. Thanks, Pop. Love you. Have a safe trip.
Have a good one.
Who knows?
I beg your pardon.
Welcome to Portland. You're so beautiful.
We're there.
Yeah, I think this is because of you.
I just want to throw out a thanks to Jefferson for this concept.
Fit the facts together. Fit the facts together. The ocean of facts. But you haven't figured out the drop to drink. Too many of the questions that occur to me are kind of stupid questions.
I think it's stupid. Let's ask them and get it done.
This is Thank You Democracy. I'm Jeff. You're listening to X-Ray. In studio, we've got special guest co-host Stacey Hall, pillar of the local comedy community. And because the local Portland comedy community is one of the coolest comedy communities in town, that makes her post hoc ergo proctor hoc, which is, by the way, Latin irony for the Latin irony fans out there, makes her a pillar of the national comedy scene. Stacey, long time no see.
Thanks so much. I really hope by the end of the show you extend it out to the world.
Well, we'll
or
see.
The universe.
I probably should.
You're underselling me.
That's a good point because the comedy scene in the United States probably is the best.
In the world. I mean, I think it would be un-American of us to say anything less.
And this, as far as we know, is the best planet in the universe.
Certainly must be.
Stacey Hall, pillar of the comedy community of the universe.
Thank you. It's about
right.
time.
Also in studio right now, we have Bob Salinger. Let me cue up Bob. Right now, there's been lots of talk about what's happening in Harney County. It touches on a lot of themes. It relates to a lot of questions that we're wrestling with. This occupation of the bird sanctuary has tapped into something nationally. I find it a fascinating topic. I find it fascinating, and I did some thinking about why it's tapping in so much, and I want others' insights also. But there's so many topics in the collective consciousness in the public debate that it touches on. Our debate on guns, their totem, race, religion, our country that is more divided politically, not maybe further away on issues, but at least more aligned, rural, Republican, conservative, urban, Democrat, liberal, those three things on each side go together more than they have in any other time probably in our history when it used to be more muddled. Terrorism, what it includes and doesn't include, what it means to be an American, who we are, our Constitution, the 21st century government, even environment and climate change. Also just what's happened to the media, including social media. We cannot resist a spectacle. Everybody's talking about this in part because everybody's talking about this. We're hoping to get past just the rubbernecking, just the, wow, look at that. Some guys with guns are doing something weird for a weird reason. They're saying weird stuff. Look at that, y'all Qaeda. And hopefully elevate our understanding and use this as an opportunity to elevate our understanding. So we've brought in somebody to help. His name is Bob Salinger. He is with the Audubon Society. He's the conservation director. Because one of the elements of this that's going on is actually what their beef is. That's not, so much is not talked about. It gets simplified. I want to understand actually what the beef is and what is the origin of our land use laws. What's going on with federal lands? Why do we own this land? Bob Salinger, how you doing, man?
Good. How are you doing today?
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Thanks for having me on.
So what's going on down there?
Well, you know, Malheur is this incredible place. And as I think everyone knows, it was occupied by armed, self-styled militia last week. And they continue to occupy it. which is an incredibly sad thing because Malheur is one of our most important wildlife
refuges.
You've been there? I've been there many, many times. I've done a lot of work out there.
Describe it to people.
Malheur is an 187,000-acre refuge. It has huge, huge wetlands, Malheur Lake. It's fed by two rivers, the Sylvies River from the north and the Blitzen River from the south that comes off of Steens Mountain. And it is incredibly important for birds. Hundreds of thousands of waterfowl pass through Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Tens of thousands of shorebirds, over 300 different species are found there. In many cases, we're talking about a significant portion of the world's population. For example, 20% of the white ibises, white-faced ibises in the entire world use Malheur Wildlife Refuge. The largest concentration of sandhill cranes on any refuge in the western United States occurs at Malheur. So it's really a very incredible place. And Portland Audubon actually played a key role in protecting it back in 1908.
Why'd all the birds go there?
Because it is this huge wetland on the Pacific Flyway, and that's what birds need when they're migrating. They need this incredible habitat for them, and in an area where there's not a lot of places to forage and not a lot of good stopover habitat, Malheur is a giant place where birds stop. It's also a place that's incredibly productive historically. Upwards of 180,000 waterfowl were produced on Malheur Lake historically. Huge, huge numbers of ducks hatching there. That has fallen off in recent decades because of an invasive carp. Carp have established there, as they have in many places. Some estimate that Malheur Lake has the highest concentration of carp ever found on the planet. These carp destroy wetlands. Unfortunately, what they do is these wetlands used to have a lot of grasses, a lot of forage, places for ducks to nest. And what carp do is they eat all the vegetation, they stir up the sediments, and they turn it into just open black water. And so the duck production has fallen off there very dramatically.
So during this time where it's being occupied, is there work that isn't able to get done? Is there actual damage? Is there any urgency to getting them out of there?
There's absolutely urgency, and there's urgency for many reasons. First of all, these are public lands. I mean, these are owned by the American people, and they were set aside to protect this incredible wildlife, and it's absolutely unacceptable that someone goes in there and appropriates these lands for their own very narrow uses. It's absolutely inappropriate that we would allow people to go in at gunpoint and threaten people and intimidate people and take these public lands. And that in and of itself is reason to get these people out and prosecute them. And they absolutely should be prosecuted. There's been talk that maybe they'll just be allowed to leave and go home. These are folks that have done this before, and it's time to say no. It's time to get them out. And, you know, we want it done safely, obviously, and whatever that takes. But when they do leave, they need to be arrested, they need to be prosecuted, and they need to sit their asses in jail.
So let me ask, stupid question time, what's the difference between a wetland and a swamp?
Oh, you know, swamp is a derisive word for wetland.
Okay, good. I thought they might be. Okay, good.
And historically, you know, people would call them swamps, and they would fill them because they didn't see any purpose in them.
Yeah.
In many ways, the same, people used to say that old-growth forests were decadent. There's all this, stuff around.
Like decay.
Decay and these down trees, and we just need to get them out of there.
Yeah.
And what we've learned is—
Clear the brush.
Yeah, that many of the things that historically were considered decadent are actually, or swamps, or whatever derisive term you want to use for the environment, are actually some of the most productive, important places.
Yeah, because they're living. And they got little tiny living stuff.
Yeah, you know, nature's messy. And, you know, it's not this neat, orderly thing. It's messy. But Malheur wetlands are incredibly important. And it was protected originally because it was under threat. Our founder, in fact, Portland Audubon was founded in large part to protect Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. We were founded in 1902, and William Finley, who's an incredible naturalist, should be far better known than he is, went out there and took pictures of the wildlife that was out there, the incredible wildlife, the incredible bird life, and also the slaughter that was occurring back in the first part of the 1900s. People were going out there and killing massive number of birds for their feathers, and they were using them in the plume trade for women's hats. He sent these to Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt met with him. Audubon advocated for the protection of Malheur, Klamath, and Three Arch Rocks, and in 1908, Roosevelt established it as one of the first wildlife refuges in the western United States. So we have a history going back to its founding, and it really is an incredible place. And there's some incredible work going on there as well. But you ask the question, you know, what's not getting done? There's incredibly important work, and we can talk about what that is. And there's a lot of consensus around this that isn't getting discussed, and it really should be, including the local community. But when somebody takes over a wildlife refuge, everything stops. These folks are all focused on the occupation. I know that there is inadequate staff there to do the important work of restoration, monitoring, management, and it's a huge refuge, massive area, very few staff. Anything that takes staffing away from the refuge is going to have a real impact. And in fact, there are many stakeholders investing in the refuge. We work along with many other groups, including people in the local community, to raise funds for the refuge because it doesn't have adequate funding. Audubon actually contributes $20,000 a year to pay to send a staff person out there to augment them to do their monitoring because they don't have staff to do
it. Federal funding for federal lands, et cetera, has gone way down over the last 30 years.
It has.
And that impacts how well we can take care of the public thing. Stacey, and by Stacey, I mean Stacey Halal, Curious Comedy. What has struck you about the coverage? What questions have you had? What is, as a human being in the world, what has sort of been your reflections as you watch this? And in this moment, I want to bring in Michael Bloom, who's the Bain faculty, Jeffrey Bain faculty scholar and professor of law at Lewis and Clark Law School, who specializes in environmental and natural resource law. But even just before we do, sort of what's been your take on any of this stuff?
I think it's interesting that it's not taken very seriously, and and that's what's interesting talking to you about really what's at stake there. I think people are really missing the point, and I don't know if it's part of your work, which I imagine is something that is often undervalued and underappreciated, the kind of work and conservation work. It's something people don't understand, the migration of birds and why a piece of land is so important and how the importance of those birds affects all of our climate and everything in the world. So I feel like on one hand, people don't really appreciate, it reflects a lack of appreciation and what conservationists do. And then on the other hand, it also is interesting to me that it's playing out like a reality show. It's kind of like Party Down South. Like, people are looking at these people like characters who are drinking, falling asleep in their truck, and making fun of them, while there's a very real group of people whose everyday work and very important work is being affected.
Saul Alinsky, I think Rule 5 of Rules 12 Rules for Radicals, said that ridicule is the people's most potent weapon. And a lot of what's been happening among liberal dialogue in critiquing what's happening with the Bundy folks in Malheur County is ridicule, is vanilla ISIS, is Al-Qaeda. And you don't want to remove that tool from the debate and dialogue, but I think it has kept us from asking serious stuff. It's kept us, this is the first time I've even thought about the work that's happening there, or what's happening on federal lands. It wasn't until an episode of News of My Dad that it even occurred to me that maybe the mandatory minimum sentences that are placed for stuff like this should be looked at, because one of the things that triggered, in fact, the thing that triggered them was with a judge saying, "Yeah, I think that 5 years is probably too many for what you did, but we're gonna put you, so you're gonna be out in a year. Oh, but now you're going back." Whether or not, however long they should be in jail, that issue has barely been covered, because all we've been doing is poking fun. Look at those weirdos. Look at them. Wow, look at that. I want to bring in Michael Bloom. Michael Bloom is at Lewis and Clark Law School, because also we want to get to some of the legal issues here. Michael, how you doing?
Good.
Good.
Enjoying the show.
Good. Us too. All right. Legally, what is the strongest argument? Pretend you're their lawyer, which might be unfair. What is the strongest argument, maybe for them staying out of jail, but also what's their best argument constitutionally and legally, so for their take on what should or shouldn't be happening on federal lands?
If I was their lawyer, I wouldn't want to take the case to court. Because I don't think there is a case.
Yeah.
It's been resolved many times that the federal government authority under the property clause, which they apparently, you know, they talk about constitutional government, but they apparently haven't read the property clause. And it's not hard to find. It's Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2. It's kind of easy to remember. You can go right to it. And it says that the federal government, Congress has the authority to promulgate all needful rules and regulations respecting public lands. And it's been interpreted consistently since 1840 to be without limitations. So if what they're trying to do is set up a court case, it's not going to last very long, because we believe in precedent in this country, and the Supreme Court about a half a dozen times has said that the federal government's authority to manage public lands is plenary. So if I was their lawyer, I'd say, well, we're not going to win in court. Let's go to Congress and see if we can't convince Congress to give public lands back to local citizens. I don't think that's likely to happen, but there are some people in Congress who support that. But that's really the only way, because the authority to manage public lands under Article 4 rests with Congress. So convince Congress to give away public lands, and we'll see about whether the people in Massachusetts and Michigan and Minnesota and all the other places back east care enough about their ownership in places like Malheur to say, no, we're not going to give them away.
So it's settled law. Property clause is settled law, and there's been lots of Supreme Court rulings on it. Is there, even like the Federal Society, among kind of conservative and right-wing legal philosophers, do they have papers out there saying, no, the property clause should have a more limited interpretation? This is too much big government. Or is there an argument out there bubbling somewhere this could bring up? Or is this really just silliness?
Well, there is. The state of Utah has commissioned and is paying several million dollars to various groups to help their attorney general bring a case that says that the claims that the federal government promised to dispose of Utah lands, and it hasn't done so, and therefore it's breached its duty to the citizens of Utah. That's in the Statehood Acts, not in the Property Clause. The state, and Oregon has a similar law, there are similar language in its Statehood Act that talks about the disposition of federal lands. And in truth, federal lands are disposed of every day, or at least every week.
When you say disposed of, what do you mean?
Under the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, there's authority to sell federal lands, and the federal government does all the time. It doesn't sell enough lands to satisfy the state of Utah, but there's no requirement that the federal government sell any lands. It's discretionary.
So I want to bring this back to Oregon. So if there is an argument that the property clause is too broad, or even if we take it away from the specific argument with respect to a specific clause of the Constitution, their general argument has been federal government shouldn't own land. Maybe it's okay for them to own a little bit of land like where the White House is, but it's not okay for them to go out and land grab and create like Yosemite. I want to ask you this question.
I think you're giving them way too much credit here, Jefferson. I think there's a discussion to be had. And I think there's some very important dialogue going on and out in Eastern Oregon. And I go out there a lot, and I've worked on Malheur for years, and we have a very, very important dialogue going on. It's not this one. These folks came in here originally under the pretext of defending an arsonist and a couple of guys that shot a herd of deer, did poaching.
Well, let's take them out of it.
And then they turned around and said, no, this is about federal lands. And then when that doesn't work, they say, it's about God sending us here. They are there for their own narrow interests. They are armed, militant, racist.
So let's set
them
aside.
I don't think we should give them that kind of credibility that they're bringing this forward. They are grasping at straws and trying to cause divisiveness.
I hear you. So set them aside. I'm still interested in the policy question. I'm still interested in, because we have taken federal lands for granted, I'm going to say for 50 years, this idea
that... Oh, we don't take them for granted. No one takes
them for
granted.
You don't think so?
I think... people are passionate about their federal lands.
All right, lay it on
me. I think people really care about them. I think they love these places. I think the professor is absolutely right that if it was put to a vote, I think Americans overwhelmingly love their public lands, their national parks, their national forests, their wildlife refuges, value them very, very highly, and would not support transferring them back into private use. And we're not just talking about transferring them back to the state. I mean, what these folks are really about is transferring them back to the private sector. These are folks that have run their cattle illegally without paying for them on public lands for years. And when the government tried to enforce these very below market rates, bragged about aiming guns at federal agents' heads. So, you know, these are the kinds of people we're talking about. And I think we actually do need to keep focus on what they're doing. You're absolutely right. The media has done an abysmal job. They've turned this into a cartoon. You know, they've had the opportunity to ask these guys questions over and over and over again, and they ask absolute crap. How are you feeling today? Are you going to leave? How about asking them, let's talk about your racism. Let's talk about the avowed racists in your group. Let's talk about whether it's appropriate to aim guns and brag about it at people's heads. Let's talk about stealing from the public, because that's what you're doing. You're stealing this wildlife refuge, and you are stealing from the public when you run your cattle on public lands and refuse to pay for it. Let's have the media, if they're going to be there, actually ask them real questions and discuss real issues about what these folks are doing, and then let's get them the heck out of there and put them in jail. And that's where we need to go on this thing. And then we'll continue to have a discussion about public lands. And let's talk about that for a minute, because Malheur is actually an incredible place. And one story that does need to be told is that back in 2010, Malheur, like every refuge in the United States, had to do a 20-year plan for how it's going to manage its lands. Unlike every other refuge in the United States, Malheur agreed to have a collaborative process. And they initiated a 3-year process, brought in community members, county commissioners, environmental groups, soil and water conservation districts, agencies, the Paiute tribe. And we worked together for 3 years. We came up with a plan, and I think it's one of the most important restoration projects in the Western United States, that everybody agreed to. No one thought we could get there, but we actually achieved consensus. And we've been working together ever since on the ground. I look at Malheur National Wildlife Refuge as an incredible opportunity for collaboration and consensus rather than what these folks want to turn it into, which is this opportunity for divisiveness and conflict.
Why do you, both of you, I'm curious, why do you think that it's been taken so lightly by the media?
Well, because for me, and I might even ask Michael Bloom also, as a media watcher, your view of the coverage of this. My view is what's happening with media generally is we give candy because candy sells. And if you put candy next to Melba Toast, Melba Toast is healthier, but everybody's going to get candy 9 times out of 9. And I think that we have a duty is people involved in the democratic conversation, small d, to understand that that is part of its purpose. And that a spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down is great. But if all you do is take medicine and grind it into sugar and deliver only that, well, then the world's going to go stupid. So I think it's the same thing. I mean, heck, it's why we started this little radio station. It's exactly why we're having this conversation. It's why we're hoping to bring on people like you guys to have these kinds of conversations so we can at least have a mild oasis to assuage our own guilt over what's happening in the country, even if we're not impacting as much as we wish we were. That's my take. But I also think there's something else. So, and this gets into media critique, and I also want to get it back to kind of policy thing that we have these wonderful guests about, but let me give you one other piece, is that typically media is selected not for understanding, okay, because this stuff is hard. Bob Salinger's been working on this for a long time. Michael Bloom went to law school, has been teaching. Understanding this stuff is hard, but you're not selected for that to be in the media. You're selected for being good looking. You're selected maybe for being good sounding on the radio, but TV is a big thing. We need to get more understanding. I have Bob, feel free to weigh in on that. Michael Bloom, feel free to weigh on that. But I also want to ask you, what's at stake here? Weigh in on how the media coverage has been, but with an eye to what you think actually should be at stake here. Michael, let's go with you first.
Well, it would be nice if the public realized what its stake was here, because I do think that, you know, it's a political issue. It's not a legal issue about ownership of public lands. That's been settled. The legal issue's been settled. So if the public doesn't care and wants to convey away the Malheur and other public lands, it could. I don't think it would. You know, the public hasn't been aroused. Usually the public isn't very doesn't look very favorably upon public giveaways to private interests. And I'd be fairly confident that there wouldn't be very much support for a proposal like this. And if there was any real momentum behind it, I would have thought that Congress would have at least floated the idea, but nobody is. So it's just these militants who've got their own warped view of the Constitution, which is ahistorical and atextual, and has no support in the courts. And I'd be very confident that if we got some decent coverage here, the public would support the federal retention of the lands that the public owns, and would not look very favorably upon giving them away to ranchers. One thing I would say that I do have some sympathy with the Hammonds on, someone mentioned it earlier, is that this whole thing started ironically over mandatory minimum sentencing. Mandatory minimum sentencing is a terrible idea, and has always been a terrible idea, but it has been supported by mostly conservatives and right-wingers as a way to limit the discretion of quote-unquote liberal judges who don't mete out tough enough sentences for people they don't like, the law involved in this case was an anti-terrorist law, but it's been applied to all manner of individuals. The judge in this case said, looking at the offense here, he didn't think 5 years was a suitable sentence, and the Ninth Circuit reversed him because it said Congress took that discretion away.
You don't get to say so, yeah.
That's a silly thing. The state has done the same thing with its mandatory minimums. Judges are in a much better position to sentence criminals than legislatures are. There's just no question about it. And we can't afford to keep mandatory minimums anyway because they're too expensive. The prison populations are filled with people who don't belong there. And part of it is mandatory minimum. So I do have some sympathy with the Hammonds on that ground, but that isn't the issue that the militants are talking about.
Right. They're not there about mandatory minimums. They want to put the blame on somewhere else. But I want to ask, I want to bring Bob Salinger, by the way, you're listening to X-Ray. I'm Jeff. We've got co-host Stacey Halal from Curious Comedy. We've got Michael Blum from the Lewis and Clark Law School. And right now, Bob Salinger, the Audubon Society. Bob, if there is this moment, and there is, that is focusing the nation's attention on something. Mm-hmm. And if our critique over the last some number of minutes has been it's focusing our attention on the wrong things, where should the focus be going? What do you hope comes out of this?
Well, you know, what I hope is that there has been this incredible collaborative project going on out there, and that's gotten very little media, and it needs a lot more support, and it's involved the local community and the environmental groups, and we actually did come together and have a 20-year plan, including the restoration of Malheur Lake, one of the most important one of the most important restoration projects in the Western United States. I hope what we do is we redouble our efforts to work together, to collaborate, to fund this because it needs more funding. Because this is a bright spot in a landscape that does have a lot of conflicts, and I don't want to undersell that. There are lots and lots of conflicts out there, but Malheur's been a bright spot, and we need to nurture that collaboration. We need to fund it.
Why has it been a bright spot? Because people have come together.
Because we have come together.
Often divisive stuff. There's people from different sectors saying, "Hey, here's the smart stuff we can do with this land."
Yeah, we worked together for 3 years to figure out what we could really do together, both on and off refuge.
And what did you decide to do? Quick version.
Restore Malheur Lake, support traditional agricultural practices, flood irrigation that also support birds on private lands. Very, very important projects and huge projects. I mean, it is a massive project, and it will take 20 years to do it. And we set aside a lot of our differences, and people have stuck there. They've come back to the table over and over again. They've worked together. We were implementing this project, and that's what gets lost. So where we have this opportunity to nurture collaboration, consensus, and things that will help the environment and the economy, we need to take advantage of it. And so let's redouble our efforts and go back there and show these folks that we can get it done together. Also, one last thing. You know, I think people love to talk about giving the land back to the people. Let's talk about giving the land back to the people, because the rightful first owners of this place, the people, the first peoples of this place, were the Paiutes. They weren't the ranchers. And if these folks are really serious about giving the land back to the first people that had it, it's the Paiutes. So let's think about that for a little while. These folks are hypocrites.
Professor, give us a closing word.
Well, the other story that Bob that's related to what Bob was suggesting is that the reason why the Malheur still exists over several controversies is the local people wanted it, and they supported the federal government over large landowners who were irrigating the Blitzen River and actually destroying it. And the locals didn't want that. They thought they'd get the small farmers, small ranchers, thought they'd get a better deal with the federal government. So they supported the federal government, and they don't support this occupation. Maybe that's the story. And then we can get into the collaboration that Bob's talking about with the 20-year refuge plan.
Professor Blum of Lewis and Clark Law School, thank you so much for joining us. Bob Salinger, the Audubon Society, thank you. Staying with us for the next hour, our guest co-host, Stacey Hillel, Curious Comedy. Stacey, it's delightful having you.
Thanks for having me.
Stay tuned. You're listening to X-Ray, KXRY Portland, 107.1 FM and 91.1 FM, streaming around the world online at xray.fm. Radio is yours. The West was a place that felt free when it was easy. But now we've been doing stuff in the West, and we got to pay attention. We talk about water policy, and we talk about federal lands. We're coming to grips with free riding we've been doing for decades and decades and decades. And now we got to come to grips with paying the piper. I want to say thanks to our guests for joining us, and thanks to listeners. Stay tuned. We're going to talk to Jenna Ewell, who was with President Obama during his speech. Friend of the show. This is X-Ray.
X-Ray FM would like listeners to know about FreeGeek, a Portland-based nonprofit committed to transforming youth technology into opportunity, education, and community. As an official Oregon eCycles drop site, FreeGeek teaches volunteers how to refurbish used technology, including computers, tablets, TVs, smartphones, and more. These are then sold in FreeGeek's electronics thrift shop to support hardware grants to thousands of nonprofits, schools, and community change organizations. Find out more at www.freegeek.org or 503-232-9350.
And we're back. This is X-Ray. This is Thank You Democracy. I'm Jefferson Smith. In studio, guest host Stacey Hillel. As we've said, as we're trying to make clear, as we're trying to clarify, using what we call logic. Stacey Hillel is the founder of Curious Comedy, and the Al Jane Comedy Fest is thereby a pillar of the Portland comedy community. The Portland comedy community is potentially, we think, almost inarguably, one of the coolest comedy communities in the country. That makes Stacey a pillar of the national comedy community. What we discovered in our discussion today is that the United States comedy community might be the leading, probably is, leading comedy community in the world. And as far as we know, this planet is in fact the locus of life as we know it in the known universe, which, if you follow that, what we call logic, Stacey Hillel is a pillar of the comedy community of the universe.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. On the phone, we have a guest who's also a friend of the show. Her name is Jenna Ewell. She is with Gun Owners for... She's not with Gun Owners for Responsible Leadership. She is an activist working on gun safety. She was in Washington, D.C., watching President Obama's speech on the topic. We'll talk about that. Jenna, how are you doing?
Hey, Jefferson. Thanks so much for having me. I'm good.
What brought you to Washington, D.C.?
Well, I received an invite from the president to attend his meeting to announce executive actions to improve gun safety in America. So
you
pretty
said yes.
Cool opportunity, one I definitely could have passed up.
So I've been invited to the White House one time. I also said yes, but I didn't get to see the president. That's not true. I did see the president, but it was very brief. How come he invited you? Some of this is review for longtime fans of the show, and for those dozens of people, thank you so much. But talk about your background on this, and I know some of that includes some personal pain.
Yeah, definitely. So my mom, Cindy Yule, was shot and killed 3 years ago at the Clackamas Town shooting in Portland, Oregon. It was December 11th, 2012. It was exactly 2 weeks before Christmas. And my mom was great. She was an incredible woman, an incredible mother. She was a hospice nurse, so she took care of people as they were dying. She was down to earth. She was lots of fun. She loved being outdoors. I don't know. I could go on and on. She was wonderful, and everyone loved her. And she should still be here today. And she's not, because of an irresponsible gun owner.
And that got, you active on the issue. You hadn't previously been active on the issue. Now you're on the board, and I did say it right, for the Gun Owners for Responsible Ownership.
Yes, exactly.
Talk about the organization. 10 years ago, as I continue to, you know, it's not even humble brag. It's just like talk about stuff that I did one time. I had a conversation on this topic and said something that ought to happen in this debate is there ought to be mildly responsible gun owners who are talking about what would gun ownership look like. The analogy is made to cars. Well, you want to take guns away because people die. You want to take cars away? No, the argument here is only to regulate. And there's a lot of car owners who are involved on how to smartly regulate cars. What's the take of gun owners for responsible ownership? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, just to back up a bit. So I started getting pretty involved in this issue almost immediately after my mom was killed. I wasn't willing to accept the fact that my mom was killed for nothing. It shouldn't have happened, so I have made it my mission to change that so this doesn't keep happening to other families. So part of that was helping to found a group in Oregon called Gun Owners for Responsible Ownership, which I still serve on the board and I'm very active in. And this great group are it's exactly as it sounds. They are gun owners who want to talk about responsible gun ownership and what that means and being safe for guns and the fact that we most definitely can respect the Second Amendment and improve gun safety in this country. And those two things are not contradictory and don't have to be. The president talked about this in his town hall event with CNN last night, which I was a part of, which was an incredible experience. And just what you were saying about
what does responsible gun ownership mean?
It's just responsible gun ownership means you are accountable and responsible for your gun. So
what's the platform?
It's just, I mean, we can all own guns. That's not the issue here. No one is trying to take away your guns. But as a gun owner, it's your responsibility to be safe with that gun, to make sure you know how to use it, how to store it properly, to make sure little kids aren't getting access to your gun and accidentally shooting themselves or other people, making sure that your gun isn't left out so someone could steal it and go use it in a shooting, which is exactly what happened at Clackamas Town Center.
Stacey Halal, Curious Comedy, guest co-host today. This speech by the president made obviously national news and lots of national commentary and made him emotional in a way that other talks haven't been. In fact, a critique of the president has been that he doesn't get emotional. It's also a compliment of the president. What was your take after seeing it?
Well, I think
I want to ask Stacey. Go. Sorry, Janet. Just a second. Stacey, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry.
I think this president has had to spend a lot of time visiting places where people have lost loved ones, and I think it's become an extremely emotional issue for him. I mean, it's so many, just too many times he's had to walk places and look at families, and like you, and I'm so sorry you had your experience. It's so tragic and out of the blue and painful, and I do think it's an issue that got beyond his wall and has affected him really deeply.
Janet, what's next? What do you think the president, what I found, one of the things I found somewhat interesting about this is essentially what the president did was take the argument that's been being made by, heck, even NRA members for a long time. We don't need new gun laws. We just need to enforce the ones we have. And he took that, okay, we're going to step up enforcement on the gun laws that we have. And of course, that gets critiqued as well. I know we're touched to be there. What do you think happens now?
You know, it took a lot of courage for the president to do what he did, and I'm really proud of him. This issue has been really important to him for a long time, but he hasn't been able to get anywhere on it because Congress has been blocking him. So I think it's really great that he stepped up and basically said, all right, fine, I'm going to do everything in my legal authority to make some changes here. Yeah, I mean, definitely we need to see more changes from Congress on a federal level. That's not going to happen until we elect a new congressman. So the real change here, though, is going to continue in the state, and that's where it started. This is a state-by-state thing, and we're already making incredible progress across the country in various states, and Oregon actually is a great example of that. We passed a background check, the universal background check bill, this last legislative session, and are acting as a leader in this country for other states to do the same.
I'm curious what other steps you would like to see Congress take.
Yeah, your universal background check is like kind of the big, obvious, easy one right now. Really common sense, should not be controversial. But yeah, you're right. I want to see a lot more than that, and there's a lot more that we can do. I am particularly interested in legislation around liability, and you know, this goes back to the idea of being a responsible gun owner and holding people accountable when
and by liability you mean so the gun owner could be sued as well as maybe put in jail, but also maybe so gun manufacturers could be sued for not putting in safety measures. Is that what you're talking about?
Sure, exactly. I mean, it's the same idea as your car. Like, every car comes with a title. You're responsible for your vehicle. If you're a gun owner, be smart. Like, it's not okay to just say, oops, I left my gun out. Someone else took it. You know, that's that. No. Or oops, I left my gun out and now my kid accidentally shot themselves. No, that shouldn't have happened. It's completely preventable.
I've heard people talking about gun insurance. What's your take?
Yeah, honestly, I think it's a great idea. It'd be a great way for the insurance companies to make money, so they should be all for it. I think it's smart. It keeps people accountable, and it's just one more thing we can do to make it harder for people to get guns, which is another easy way for us to slowly make changes here and make things better.
I think about car insurance, and I'm like, you know, not everyone has it, even though they're supposed to,
yeah.
Right? So if you get hit by somebody and they don't have insurance, there isn't much you can do, get blood out of a stone if they don't have any money and they don't have any insurance. But at the same time, mortgages require you to have insurance, and they find out if you don't, but they have a financial interest. I wonder how we would be able to monitor insurance and make sure gun owners were actually maintaining it.
Yeah, you got any take on that, Jenna?
Sorry, what were you going to say, Jefferson?
I was just encouraging you to answer the question instead of me. Go ahead.
That's obviously a valid point and something to think about, something that have to be explored. I imagine it would work similarly to how insurance works now with other things like, houses or cars or whatever. Obviously not everyone is always going to follow the law all the time. We're always going to have some people who drive without insurance or whatever, but that's not a reason to to try and make things safer and not implement new laws for the benefit of the community just because someone might not follow them.
And the counter argument that comes is, related to what Stacey said, if guns don't kill people, people do. And if the argument is the best solution of a bad person with a gun is a good person with a gun, then, and if our worldview is that there's sort of good gun owners and bad gun owners, the only people who are going to insure their guns are good gun owners. The only people who are going to register any of this stuff are good gun owners. Otherwise, it's going to be bad gun owners. The retort to that, I guess, is that's not exactly how the world works. People don't move in just one or the other category. You do stuff like this, and you can see a gradual reduction. And a gradual reduction of 1, 2, 3, 1,000, a couple hundred mass shootings is a big deal over a few years. But what's been your response when you hear the well-worn arguments of gun extremists on issues like this?
Yeah, exactly what you said. It's just ridiculous. Okay, so are we not going to outlaw murder because, people are still going to kill people? It just doesn't work like that. This is a complicated issue, and there's no one solution that's going to solve everything and stop every act of gun violence. But the goal here is to figure out what we can do to make things safer and make it harder for people to get guns who shouldn't have them. And there are lots of ways for us to do that while still respecting the rights of gun owners.
What was the mood in the room? When you were there, the president was giving this speech. I watched the clips, and as I watched the clips, what I most interestingly heard was the sound that almost sounded like gunfire of all of the cameras going off the moment they saw a tear going down. But set the scene for us. What was the mood in the room?
It was incredible to be there. It was emotional, honestly. It's clear that the president really cares about this issue, and that came across in his speech and everything that he was saying. Especially at that moment, he literally had everyone in that room. He had everyone's attention and everyone feeling that same way. And, certainly reminded all of us who've been through this what that feels like, and made it pretty easy for anyone else to relate to that.
Well, I want to say thank you so much to you, Jenna, for joining us. Stacey, you got any closing thought on this?
It just reminds me of New York in the 80s, where it's just a mess. It was like there was graffiti everywhere. There was violence everywhere. You couldn't walk safely down the street, and it seemed like an insurmountable issue. And I feel like if you take a multi-prong approach and have some hope and have people fighting like this, getting the word out that hopefully we'll be able to reach that tipping point where this is something that happens rarely instead of often.
Giuliani will take care of it.
Yeah.
Jenna Yule, Jenna Yule, you got a closing thought for us. Where can people find out more?
Every town is a great place to start. Every town for gun safety. Go to their website and sign up for email updates. Here in town in Oregon, there's the Oregon Alliance for Gun Safety. Moms Demand Action. There are tons of groups out there, tons of ways to get involved. And everyone start getting involved. We need everyone's help. That's what it's going to take.
Jenna Yule, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jefferson.
You're listening to X-Ray. This is Thank You Democracy. I'm Jeff. We're here with special guest co-host Stacey Halal of Curious Comedy.
Savior of the Universe. As we've decided.
She'll save every one of us. That was like the Flash Gordon.
It is. That's exactly. Yeah.
Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
And now is time for a special segment. Before that, I want to thank the following sponsors. Liberty Coin and Currency. If you can check them out and learn more at libertycoinandcurrency.com. Hosley Eco Automotive. HosleyEcoAutomotive.com. Also, segment sponsors, Eyes on Broadway, Morrell Inc., Zero Res, Carpet Cleaning, Beth Ernest & Associates Real Estate with Keller Williams Realty, Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, and Liberty Capital Investments. I want to thank all of those sponsors and more, all the folks who help make X-Ray Morning Programming and X-Ray possible, and including you, X-Ray members who go on to X-Ray.fm and click the blue donate button, who buy tickets to the event that we're doing, the X-Ray Awards show and Radio is Yours on January 22nd. We got Steve Malcolmus playing. We got awesome bands. You can check all that out at x-ray.fm. I want to thank all of you for making X-Ray a possibility. And right now we got Talk Media News. Joining us is Victoria Jones of Talk Media News, formerly Talk Radio News, but now it's the 21st century and they are speeding ahead into the information superhighway. Victoria, how you doing?
I'm well, thank you. Well, I'm not, so please forgive me if I cough, but I'm better than I was.
We've been having a lot of that. There's been a lot of kind of the clearing of the throat, coming to grips with the fact that the day has begun. We've talked about today the militia efforts in Malheur County. We've talked also about gun control. Let's go beyond that. What are the big stories? What are the big five other than those two? What's happening in the country? Let us know as our traveling minstrel of information, delivering news to our small, isolated hamlet. What do we need to know, Victoria?
Well, the first thing to know is that the December job numbers came out this morning from the Labor Department. And what was projected, so I'll tease you first, what was projected by the Wall Street Journal economists who they surveyed was about 210,000 jobs. What we actually got was 292,000 jobs. So a good number. Better, quite a bit better than what was projected. So that's considered an impressive job growth for the end of the year.
Instantly, the Wall Street Journal has come out with op-eds calling Barack Obama the best economic president of a generation and working to move up his approval numbers, and everybody is recognizing that we have moved in the course of a single presidential administration from global economic crisis to better than expected job numbers. I'm sure that you're saying that all of the punditry going on there is just praising the president for his management of the economy.
Well, I don't take very much. I take no notice of the Wall Street Journal's punditry. I only ever read their reporting, which is excellent.
All right.
I've no idea what their editorial page has to say. But their reporting is calling it an impressive job growth and the latest sign of a stable U.S. economy despite international headwinds that have worsened since 2016 began. So that's what they're calling it.
How come? Why is it better?
Why is what better?
Why is the economy better? Is it magical economy pixie dust? Is it a something we have to bring on somebody else to talk about?
No, it's not. It's not magical pixie dust, particularly since revisions showed employers added 50,000 more jobs in October and November than previously estimated. Job growth has been good and has been growing for years now. For all of 2015, the economy added an average of 221 jobs a month. It's a slowdown from 2014, but it's still the second best year for job creation since 1999. There is a recovery underway. The issue still is wage gains, and there's modest wage growth, and that's considered a concern that there is a tighter labor market. Why is it not? And I don't have the answer to this. I'm just reporting? Why is it not being reflected in better paychecks? And that is something that is really flummoxing economists.
Well, we'll have to talk about that. What's our next story? What else is going on? What do we need to know in our small, isolated hamlet?
Another thing that's going on, and this is going to happen this afternoon, is the White House this afternoon, representatives from White House officials, Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough, Presidential Counterterrorism Advisor Lisa Monaco, AG Loretta Lynch, FBI Director, the National Intelligence Director, National Security Agency Director, all of those and others, as well as the DNI, they're all going to Silicon Valley in California, and they're going to meet with executives there to talk about how to counter the use of social media by militant groups. And basically, they're looking to do more to combat online propaganda from groups like ISIS, obviously following the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino.
Well, one thing they did was they hired a spokesperson with a British accent, and under the argument apparently that it would increase credibility. Is that why you decided to begin to use a British accent despite growing up in Alabama?
Yes, because I can say anything and people believe me.
that's excellent. What Stacey, we're here with Stacey, the Law of Curious Comedy as well. Stacey, feel free to jump in if you have any takes on this news that's being delivered to us very credibly by Victoria Jones from Alabama.
Yeah, I have no questions. I'm just taking it all in and believing
in
every word she says. That's all that can be done.
She sounds very credible, doesn't she?
She does.
Yeah, she ought to be on like National Public Radio.
Well-known fact. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. I have said things in my reports for Talk Media News. I mean, occasionally on a boring day, I'll say, you know, Queen Elizabeth II, you know, was unfaithful to Prince Philip today. Did you hear about that piece of news? And they'll go, what? I'll say it's true.
By the way,
I'll say no, it's not true.
I have a little bit of a Boston accent left over, and I don't know why, but I have the opposite effect. Nobody believes anything I say.
I'm on your side.
No,
yeah.
That's not fair.
I have to say, I hear Victoria's accent, and it makes me want to dump tea into an ocean and wage revolution. Okay, I understand. I am on the side of democracy, not monarchy. I hear your Boston accent. I think you're correct about everything. I hear Victoria's accent, and it makes me think we have to transform the fundamental ways by which
we
govern ourselves.
Well, I'm a villain in the James Bond film, basically.
You sell Jaguars, okay, which apparently is pronounced Jaguar.
I have a white cat, a fluffy white cat on my lap.
Just petting it and plotting. We're going to move on. What's the next story we need to know in our little hamlet here, Victoria Jones?
We also need to know that last night President Obama took part in a town hall on guns on CNN, which the NRA declined to participate in, saying it was going to be a PR spectacle. Well, it wasn't. Obama was in the hot seat. So this was a hashtag NRA fail. Obama fielded tough questions, not only from gun owners and gun activists, also from Anderson Cooper. Obama parried the questions. He likes back and forth. Anybody who remembers him campaigning knows this. But he grew visibly angry, he was exasperated, and at one point he snapped at Anderson Cooper when Cooper questioned his use of the term conspiracy theory. Obama snapped, "I'm sorry, Cooper, it is fair to call it a conspiracy. What are you saying? Are you suggesting we're creating a plot to take people's guns away so we can have martial law? I'm only going to be here for another year. When would I have started on this enterprise, right?"
What's happening on the campaign out there? You have a chance to follow the national presidential campaign a lot. What is your take of what's going on?
Well, a couple of things are going on. Donald Trump was in Burlington,
Who's
Vermont
that?
Last night. What? Yes, he was.
Okay.
Of course, a bastion of progressivism and the home of Bernie Sanders, who was running for the Democratic nomination. And it was very cold. It was about 10 degrees below, which becomes relevant. And Trump had a sold-out arena which seats 1,400 people. He was nevertheless heckled several times in his meandering hour-long speech. And he seemed to relish it. throw them out. No coats. Confiscate their coats, he shouted.
Their coats?
Like to make them go out in the cold,
yes.
and die.
Yes.
Yeah.
Throw them out in the cold. No coats.
That's great. That seems like the opposite, yes, of what you'd want to do when it's cold.
Well, he was throwing out the detractors.
And then making them freeze.
Yeah, the
protesters. Yes. Throw out
cut off their heads and take their oil.
Exactly.
That's his first ad. Cut off their heads and take their oil. Throw them out in the cold with no coats. We don't want any more liberal pansies with their weakness not taking people to task when they're doing things like trying to express their views in my town hall. What else we need
but
to know on the campaign?
If he throw them out with no coats, if they survive, maybe they're tough enough to become Trump supporters or something. You know, it's like a test.
It's a reality show. It's a reality show. If they don't make it in the cold, they get kicked off the island and they'd get fired. Victoria Jones from Talk Media News, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It was fun. All right. You're listening to X-Ray. I'm Jefferson Smith. That's Stacy. Say hi, Stacy.
I'm Stacy. Hi.
Stacy, where are you from?
I'm originally from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. I have to say Chelmsford because otherwise it's Chumpsford.
And what do you do now?
What do I do now?
Yeah.
I run the Curious Comedy Theater.
What happens at the Curious Comedy Theater?
Oh, boy. We have improv and sketch and stand-up comedy every single week, 13 shows a week.
Where could I find out more about the Curious Comedy Theater?
You could go to curiouscomedy.org. We are a nonprofit comedy theater.
You're listening to X-Ray. This is Thank You Democracy. We've had a good show today. If you wanted to listen to this show, if you've missed some of it, you can go on iTunes, you can go on SoundCloud. You don't have to do those things. I'm not calling you to action. I'm saying these are things you could do if you so chose. If you wanted to learn more, you could go. If you wanted to rate and review on iTunes, that option is open to you, as is giving us a 5-star review. Those options are among the options that are available to you. And you can help support things like X-Ray FM. You can go January 22nd to the event we're doing at Marmoset Music. X-Ray Awards, Radio is Yours, competition happening now. Still time to submit a radio piece, either a little nonprofit plug or your own story about your changing city. And you can win cash and prizes. True story. You can find out all about that at xray.fm. I'm allowed to say that in terms of call to action. Go to xray.fm. Help out. We're talking Islamophobia today on City Club, or at City Club. The topic is Islamophobia. What's that? You kind of get it from the name. Stay tuned for that right after the break. This is X-Ray.
X-Ray FM would like you to know about My Music RX, a program of the Children's Cancer Association. Trained My Music RX specialists invite hospitalized kids to choose the music experience that feels right for them with bedside sing-alongs, a mobile instrument lending library, and iPad checkouts to access their music medicine. More information is available at mymusicrx.org.
X-Ray FM would like listeners to know that Old McDonald's Farm Incorporated is a nonprofit organization that uses animals and agriculture to teach and reach Portland area children. Information on day visit programs, summer programs, and Saturday Academy workshops is available at www.oldmcdonaldsfarm.org.
X-Ray FM would like
We want you to tell us a story. We're putting on the first Radio Is Yours competition, where we invite the public to submit stories about changing cities and the good work being done in them. There are sweet prizes, including cash up to $500, equipment and software for producers. Go to xray.fm and click on the Radio Is Yours button on the homepage to get all the info. Don't delay. The deadline for submissions is January 8th.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from the Hollywood Theater, Portland's nonprofit historic movie theater showing classic, contemporary, and cult films every night of the week. Located on Northeast Sandy Boulevard in the heart of the Hollywood District. Showtimes and event listings at hollywoodtheater.org. Hindenburg Systems is a provider of editing software for radio journalists.
You're listening to X-Ray. I'm Jeff. This is Thank You Democracy. In studio, we've got Stacey Hillel, guest co-host from Curious Comedy.
Hello.
And in studio, we've got Casey Jama, founder and executive director for Center for Intercultural Organizing. Fun fact, just a block away from X-Ray. Casey, how you doing?
Thanks, Jeff. I'm doing great. Thank you for hosting me.
What's Islamophobia and why are we talking about it?
Well, I think, starting with a broader perspective, probably, you know, as you know, this country, every time there is a, you know, political or economic crisis, we certainly try to find out who to blame. And most of them, a lot of times, it's usually all around, you know, minority community and religious minority community. And in the past, as you know, when World War II happened, you know, we encamped and targeted the Japanese community members. Historically, if you know the issues of race and racial justice and around that, you know, it's so Islamophobia is not something new. Islamophobia, which it means is really, it's really very much, it's a fear of people who have a Muslim faith or come from the Islamic world. You know, it's been around this country for a while, but recently, especially since 9/11 happened, we have seen increased Islamophobia around the country, and now, since especially also recently, since the ISIS came along, has been also increased, and especially the Paris attacks and San Bernardino attacks, and those are the things with people who are Islamophobia. There is just observed challenges around, and Islamophobia has been increasing lately.
Kambiz Ganea Basiri, professor of Islamic and social intellectual history at Reed College, author of the book History of Islam in America, I think is joining us by phone right this moment. Are you with us, professor?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Same question. Help us define Islamophobia other than what my dumb kids guess would be, and why are we talking about it?
Yeah, and as my past, I have a little slightly different take on this, and then Casey did. I mean, people often talk about Islamophobia. Usually when you have a phobia of something, you want to stay away from it. But the folks who are Islamophobic can't seem to get enough of talking about Islam and want to really delve into thinking about Islam and talking about Islam constantly. So not sure to what extent we could think of it as just the fear of Islam, but it's an attempt to sort of concoct the fear of Islam for other reasons, for political gains, for economic gains, or for marginalizing Muslim minority communities in places like the United States or Western European countries. If you think about it that way, while anti-Muslim sentiment has been in the United States for a very long time, Islamophobia, using Islam as a way of winning political campaigns and scoring political points, is rather actually new and comes to the forefront very much after 9/11 and perhaps more importantly after the controversy around the so-called Ground Zero Mosque in Lower Manhattan.
Explain that. Give the background of the Ground Zero Mosque.
There used to be a mosque in Lower Manhattan near where the World Trade Centers that were bombed by Al-Qaeda were. And the community that was there was growing. You wanted to do something bigger, and he thought, let's think very innovatively and largely, and let's build a mosque alongside a community center that wouldn't just serve the Muslim community, but be very much alongside like the Jewish community centers that we saw pop up in cities all over the United States in the early part of the 20th century. And when some people, mostly not from New York themselves, but I thought in New York, found out about this during the 2010 congressional election cycle, they started attacking it because it was being built very close to where the World Trade Center was. And there was this idea that this Ground Zero is a sort of sacred American site, and that since Al-Qaeda is claims to be Muslim and Muslims attacked and Al-Qaeda attacked the World Trade Center, we shouldn't have a mosque built around this, and it became a very huge national controversy.
What's the source? And Stacey, jump in anytime you want, and I guess that goes for all of us. We're gonna have a morning zoo about Islamophobia and about around racial and religious tension in the world and our country. What's interesting to me is the source of this conflict, or sources of this conflict. All right, we'll play multiple choice. All right, here are the reasons why maybe there is. Well, let's just take at face value that, Professor, exactly what you said is just the truth, that there is greater use of Islam to incite fear, to make political gains, to stir controversy. There's people who gain from that. Mm-hmm. What are the sources of that? Here are some of them. I'm going to give A, B, C, D, and E, and I'm even going to give an F, all of the above. A, it's race. Mm-hmm. Lots of them Islamics, mm-hmm. aren't whiteys. Mm-hmm. Second, it's oil. Mm-hmm. Might not care, except for some of the people who lead Middle Eastern nations tend to not be Christians, tend mm-hmm. not to be Jewish, tend to be Muslim. Mm-hmm. Third, the media loves it because they can show villains who are wear turbans and look way different and look like they're from a James Bond movie. Mm-hmm. Fourth, religion. Fifth, it is just an outgrowth of historical battles that were happening between Western Greeks and Eastern Turks, going on for thousands of years, that then extended into the Crusades and then extended to the George Bush presidency. That's A, B, C, D, and E. F is some combination of the above. I guess G, it's always good to do multiple choice. It goes to G on radio and people can't read it in front of them. All of that, everything I just said is hogwash and doesn't make any sense. Stacey wants to answer first.
Well, no, not even to answer, but just say, I think just even through these introductions, a really interesting contrast is the chicken and egg question, right? So you start with fear, and then fear fuels the hate, and then the hate can be used to manipulate people and in political formats, and then fuel more fears, which then fuels more hate, and the underlying all of the A, B, C, D, E, F list you just made.
And even G. Casey, you want to go next?
Yeah, I think for me, it's, you know, I think the professor said well earlier. I think the issue to me is all, I would say it probably is all the above. But I think just if I expand a little bit about, the reality is that there's a political force that's playing on this issue. And, you know, if you can expand, if you look the history of this country is built around race and racism and oppression. And so, to me, is that if you bring this current situation where we are, you can today remove the Islam or Muslims from the equation and you put immigrants and just that piece, mm-hmm. or you put blacks, or African Americans, or you put women,
Mexicans,
and
any good radio host,
you can go on and on. If you remove that and put that in place, different groups, it's almost the
Cowboys.
It's the same thing. So to me, it's the issue is that we are really facing on these issues in a ways that we have to connect the dots and make a narrative that is, we're really, this country is going to a crossroads. And I think we have to really connect the dots and make sure these issues are interconnected and make a case around working together to change some of those dynamics.
Professor, what's the source of this?
I think you're absolutely right that the source of it is all of the above. I mean, it's all of this plus a few other things that people gain, have something to gain from this, not just the media, but I think also politicians have something to gain from this. So, for example, when Obama came to power, things that he had opposed, powers that he had the executive branch had gained that he originally opposed, he wanted to keep, but he said that I'm not going to use them, but I want to keep these powers just in case, because it becomes a means by which also the state could increase its power. The other thing you didn't mention is this sort of association between Islam and violence that's made in the contemporary era. There's all sorts of violence in the modern world, but it seems to take a particular shape when it comes to its exercise by Muslims, even though Muslims are, on the other hand, actually suffering from violence much more than the perpetrators of violence in the contemporary world. I would want to add that to the equation, and maybe more broadly the thing to think about is there generally seems to be two ways of approaching the issue of Islamophobia. One is whether or not the problem is Islam, or the other is whether the problem comes from the America or other contexts in which Muslims are minority communities in Europe or America or Australia or what we normally call us the West. And And it's not an either or, right? That there, as you mentioned, these categories, there are things that feed into each other that bring about this fear of an unknown, outgrouping of a community to be able to explain things that has nothing to do with them, actually, you know, that has nothing to do actually with the Muslims who live here or the Muslims who are participating in the modern world.
So, but I do have this question. So somebody else, maybe from a different perspective, mm-hmm. might say, hey, listen, 9/11 really did happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Daesh, the Islamic State, really is making the case, really are chopping off the heads of people, really are destroying antiquities, really are trying to build an international caliphate, really do have an argument for global power building that would be a religious state that would have one of its tenets killing Christians. Mm-hmm. That these aren't things that were just invented in some conservative's head as a boogeyman, maybe. But
yeah.
These things actually happen. How should we be thinking about that stuff? What should be our response?
If I could take a stab at that, that's an excellent question. So one way of thinking about it is just that there's something within the practice of Islam that leads to the formation of Daesh, which I would say is absolutely ignorant and cannot be empirically verified because there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world, and you know they're not supportive of Daesh. And one of the interesting things about Daesh or ISIS is that there's very little consensus among Muslim elites or Muslims in general, and all have come out to say actually what ISIS is doing is against Islam. But despite that, we seem to still, because of their exercise of violence, seem to associate them with Islam or want to think about them in terms of Islam. So that's one. The other issue is that another way of thinking about this, and what I think is a much more productive way of thinking about this, is when we look at like Daesh and its exercise of violence, it's not a random exercise of violence. It's a very controlled exercise of violence in very much ways that the state exercises violence. And in the modern era, we've given the monopolization, the state, the monopolization of violence, the monopoly over violence in the modern era. And here, Daesh, if it wants to actually, or ISIS, if it wants to actually come and say we all should be seen on the global stage as a state, it comes to actually exercise precisely that single power that we have given to the state and no one else to exercise without with impunity. So it comes to orchestrate this exercise of power through violence. And you know, very early images of like beheadings that took place. You know, they had people dressed in the same way as Guantanamo prisoners were dressed. So they were very clearly trying to imitate the ways in which a state exercises violence. So that, I think, is a much more productive way of thinking about it. And it's not to say that Islam doesn't have anything to do with this, because there are concepts in Islam that come to challenge the notion of giving all the exercise of violence to the state without any sort of ethical guidelines that come from religion. So Islam has something to do with this, with it here too, but what seems to be a much more productive way of thinking about it is like, you know, how do we exercise violence in the modern world, and how does the state actually establish itself, come to determine itself as the you know, powerful entity to which we should all concede?
I think if I jump in, I think definitely I agree. I think that first of all, I agree there's 1.6 billion Muslims around the world.
23% of the world population as of 2010 estimate.
Right. And I think for me, you know, we have to acknowledge that, I mean, there's a very, very small, tiny minority of people who are associated with the Muslim faith who are joining ISIS or fighting for ISIS. Also, I want to acknowledge most of the victims of ISIS attacks are actually Muslims themselves. I think we have to acknowledge that. Because if you look in what's happening in Syria, if you look what's happening in Somalia, if you look what's happening in Iraq, the Muslims...
It's not just 9/11 in New York and right, Paris attack.
Exactly.
And
the majority of in Nigeria, the majority of the ISIS victims are Muslims. So I think we have to acknowledge that. I think the second piece is that I think bringing home in this country, also, if you look at what Donald Trump...
Who's that?
Donald Trump is doing, and he's also generally all the other folks who are running for the highest office in this country who are giving the opportunity, recruitment opportunity for ISIS when Donald Trump comes and says, I want to, if I'm elected, I'm going to bar all the Muslims coming to this country. That is plays the hands to ISIS and uses it as a recruitment tool. So I think we have to understand that this is really, the way we are responding ourselves is not the actually appropriate way of dealing this conflict. And I think we have to come up with a better way of resolving this issue.
You're listening to X-Ray. We're talking about Islamophobia. It's the topic today at City Club. We've got Casey Jama. We've got Stacey Halal. We've got the good professor in the studio today and on the phone. My take for a while has been, and yeah, it's an armchair take, is that the cries for a caliphate, that what Daesh is doing is they're picking a fight. And they want the fight because they think the fight, that is the way, if there is a fight and if they can get more and more people to draw lines, and if we divide the world between Christians and Muslims or between Muslims and non-Muslims, then a power builder, a would-be tyrant, could get more and more people on their team. That's a good way to, recruitment is becoming a cliche. I see it more than recruitment. They're picking a fight. How do we resolve the fight? If it's not only to decry, if it's not only to sound the alarm about Islamic radicals who are doing bad things, and if we say that that's not the way to get to peace, what do we do? Professor, why don't you go?
That's a million-dollar question.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, one of... and I'm not a political scientist. I study history of religions. So I would be giving a sort of armchair response to this too. But perhaps
it's what I do, I'm sure you can do at least as well as we do. Go ahead, man.
The way in which we have thought about it from this United States perspective and European perspectives too, we sort of are developing a foreign policy based on what the crazies are doing, and I'm not sure if that's the best way of actually approaching this. Like I said here, we have actually a source of consensus that we never have in that region against ISIS. And we're not actually monopolizing on that to say, let's bring players that actually would not in the region that normally don't talk to each other, everyone from Turkey to Israel to Saudi Arabia to Iran, and say, let's bring them together and see these people who actually have to live with this and, like Casey was saying, are suffering the consequences of it the most. Things should be done, and let's actually mobilize their resources and their intelligence on these issues. One of the things is, so when we're talking at the City Club today, the title of the panel is Threat of Islamophobia. One of the negative consequences of Islamophobia is that we end up thinking about these issues in terms of what small groups of people are doing, to the point where, you know, someone using pressure cookers to create home bombs, makeshift bombs, comes to be seen as creating a weapon of mass destruction in the way that a hydrogen bomb or an atomic bomb is considered to be a weapon of mass destruction. We end up creating these equivalencies that don't actually exist. So, like, you know, ISIS is not the United States, and it's actually trying to pick a fight to be able to say, yes, we're global players, but they're by no means global players in the way that Turkey, Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia are global players, much less, you know, to talk about the United States or Russia. So my recommendation would be to use the opportunity to not develop policies based on what we think a few small groups of people who are rogue and behaving in these ways, what we ought to do about them, but rather how we could use these opportunities to think about the region differently and maybe bring people who are not normally in dialogue with one another into dialogue and see what they're able to produce.
You know, I'm half Syrian. My grandparents were Syrian immigrants in the early 1900s when Turkey was invading Syria. And, you know, what's been interesting growing up Arabic is how little information there is about anything else, Middle Eastern or Islam. I remember one class in school about Islam, and someone turned to me in the middle of that class and said he had a question and he didn't want to offend me. He was afraid to ask the question. And you know, my grandparents were actually Christian, but I didn't bother pointing that out. And I was like, well, you're not going to offend me. And he said, well, good. I don't want you to blow up my car. Oh, and it was like, you know, they're so limited. There was no education regarding the Middle East and the culture and the evolution of human civilization that's come out of the Middle East and Northern Africa. We don't know anything. I mean, when I was growing up, hummus, no one knew what that was. You know, I haven't been alive. I haven't been alive that long. And hummus and pita bread.
Hummus is huge now. Hummus is everywhere.
It's
huge. Love it.
It's the beginning.
That's the key
of
to peace.
It is. It's the beginning.
That's the key to peace.
Middle
we share
Eastern
hummus.
Food. Yeah. But you know,
Baba Ghanoush for justice.
We have these terrible ambassadors for Islam and for Arab culture and Arab people, but we have nothing to counter it. There's so little education, there's so little culture, so little voice. When I was younger, there were 100,000 Syrians in this country. It's got to be a lot more now because I know my cousins are reproducing like crazy. but people don't know Islamic people. We don't. Our cultures are still very segregated, and the lack of understanding of where the countries are in the Middle East, what they've contributed to the world. Yeah, I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. This is a sociological problem. Anyways, I think the more people actually know each other, some of these sort of stereotypes can't stick because people look to friends that they know or colleagues that they know or people who they know, and then say like, "Hey, that actually doesn't work." But there is something that have more recently, you know, seems to be much more insidious is this notion that if you come to actually say, you know, your child could become radicalized, and keep an eye on your child, and let us know if your child is doing this and X, Y, and Z. The fear of, if you concoct this fear of Islam to a large enough degree, it could actually even become that, oh, your next door neighbor you have to worry about because they're duplicitous, or you know, they say one thing and do another.
It's
and
like
that
communism
you have to
in the 50s.
And that's, so you know, we're entering into this phase that if we continue thinking about these issues not in terms of analytical terms, but in terms of the cultural terms of like there's something in this culture that produces X, Y, and Z, we're going to run into the fact, you know, to a point where even your friends won't trust each other and family members won't trust each other.
Casey.
I think in short answer, I think for me, I think we have to take the oxygen out of the ISIS recruitment. I think the reality is that we cannot invade out of our way to invade every single country that we think there is might be radical Islam. I think this
what
issue,
do we do?
I think we have to really think about other solutions. We have to figure out ways to bring people, as the professor was saying, that to have a dialogue, and we can't just win military solution out of this. I think for me, it's more about really creating a peaceful resolution to this issue, and also bringing, giving other alternative to youth who are actually in those countries who are being recruited by ISIS. Because every time that we respond militarily or we attack another country, that gives the fuel to the fire, and that gives an opportunity to ISIS say, look, see, this is what we've been telling you, and give the opportunity to recruit. So for me, let's change the strategy and talk about peaceful resolution and talk about bringing people together to resolve this issue.
So there's one other topic. We only got a couple minutes, but there's one topic I got to ask about. So you're going to City Club, you're talking about Islamophobia, and how do we make sure that we don't vilify through a lens of ethnocentrism or racism 23% of the world population based on the acts of a small fraction of that. I also, though, wonder, what is the duty of you, Casey Jama, or of you, Professor Ghanaya Basiri, in working in within the Islamic community to root out, to change even the radical violent elements, even as isolated and small as they might be, but non-zero though they are? What do you do about that?
One of the things is actually that the Muslim communities themselves have been doing this for a very long time. We just don't know about it because, like Casey said, that they're the ones who have been mostly affected by these things. And some of what we're seeing now in the United States were, you know, terrorist attacks of this sort occurred in places like Egypt and Iraq and Morocco long before they started happening in places like Paris and Boston and New York and so on. And you know, to give a concrete example, during the first Gulf War of 1990 and 91, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait had donated a lot of money to Muslim organizations in the United States, and when they wanted support for kicking Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, they came to these Muslim organizations and they said, look, we want the dividend on our investment now. Can you help support this idea? And a lot of Muslim communities turned around and said, oh, we didn't realize there were political strings attached to the money we were receiving.
Professor, thank you so much for joining us. Casey Jama and Professor Kambiz Ganea-Bissiri are going to be today at City Club. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Stacey Halal of Curious Comedy for